What is going on, everybody? John Middlecoff, that's me, Three and Out Podcast, that's this podcast. It's halftime of the Monday Night Football game. There is zero reason to wait for this bad boy to end. I mean, zero. So we'll dive into, you know, just the game's over. It's 28-3 at halftime. The Redskins, just what an all-time joke. And I got a lot going on today. You know, Danny Dimes, have some deep thoughts on Danny Dimes. The Eagles, who are in a little trouble, but let's just pump the brakes. I believe in the old gunslinger they have playing quarterback. Kyle Shanahan and just other offensive coaches, I talk about this as a theme of the show. You know, every game with a big-time coach, you should say wow multiple times. That's what good offensive coaches do. There was a play on the goal line in this game against the Redskins where Matt Nagy ran a great play where he brought this wide receiver from the other end of the field, and it was just a layup throw from Mitch Trubisky. That's what good offensive coaches do. And if you're a good offensive coach in this day and age and you have a decent defense, you're going to win. I think Kyle Shanahan is, you know, kind of proven to us that he's a really good coach. And I said that when the season started, it's time to win. That's what good coaches in the NFL are doing, and he's winning. Jim Harbaugh probably is the most polarizing coach, college or pro, going. You know, I had a front row seat for him for a couple years here in the Bay Area, and I think people are overreacting just a tad. Now, some call me a Harbaugh apologist, but you can find out for yourself. And then the Colts, why they remind me a little bit, it's different, but there are all some similarities of what Billy Beane does with the Oakland A's, and not even necessarily Moneyball, but just the way he builds his team. And then, like always, the Middlecoff mailbag, at John Middlecoff is my Instagram. You can find me there. It's the easiest way to get a hold of me. Slide up in my DMs, and I answer your questions right here on the show. And, you know, I interact with a lot of people, text or whatever, through my DMs there. Same as my Twitter handle. It's easy to follow me there. But let's start with this game. You know, I don't think it can be overstated how incredible it was that the Chicago Bears were able to take advantage of. You know, whether it's been reported pretty openly now by Chris Mortensen, who's, you know, probably besides Schefter, known as the greatest reporter in the history of the league. Like, he doesn't just make shit up. That's just not what he does. That Mark Davis did not have the money to pay Khalil Mack. And it was $90 million in guaranteed cash. And I think his signing bonus was over $60 million. That means at the moment he signs it, you have to have that cash on hand. And Mark Davis, there's a reason he, you know, flies coach like me or you. Now, some of you might not, but I do. I'm sure many people listening do. Do you understand that most owners, you know, you rent out or you charter a jet for your team. You know, 747, big jet, huge traveling party for football. Every owner in the league flies themselves. You know, they don't fly on the charter. At least, you know, anyone, maybe Virginia McCaskey does. But Jerry Jones, you know, John Mara, hell, Jed York, they fly on their own jet privately. They don't fly with the team. That's because the wealth in the NFL is at an all-time high. These owners are printing cash. Again, Mark flies in the back of airplanes. He just doesn't have the money, which is crazy. You'd be like, well, Mark, I know a couple accountants. You could write this thing off, but they just don't have the cash. They are as cash poor as any organization in a league that's printing cash. They can't make it. So the Chicago Bears, who aren't really a cash-rich organization, they're not the Cowboys, they're not the Eagles, they're not printing cash at the highest level, but they're smart. They are fiscally responsible, and they're not moving every 10 years, so they aren't always wasting money doing stupid stuff, that they were able to capitalize on what will go down as, for a historic franchise that has guys in the Hall of Fame on defense, this will go down as one of their best players ever. When Khalil Mack walks into Canton, Ohio, you know, in 15 years or whatever, and he puts on a gold jacket, he will go in as a Chicago Bear. And that trade changed the trajectory, the landscape of the NFC, and changed their franchise forever. Because without Khalil Mack, they'd still have a good defense, they would have an average offense, and a quarterback, which I struggle with. Matt Nagy somehow is able to manipulate stuff and get him to be a productive player. But the Khalil Mack addition took them from a 7 or 8 win team to a potential double-digit win team every year that he's on it. Because he takes the defense to being, I mean, they're good. They would be really good without him. He takes them to the elite defense. They're the best defense in the league. There is not a defense top to bottom at every level that is that good. Their safety plays top notch, their corner plays top notch, their linebacker plays top notch, and their defensive line play is the best in the NFL. Now, it might not statistically, but I'm just telling you, their front four is better than everyone in the league because they have Khalil Mack, and they have Akeem Hicks, and they have Floyd, and they're just so damn good. But Khalil Mack's worth like four players, a little like Aaron Donald. He's worth multiple players in himself. And there was a reason those two guys got $87 and $90 million guaranteed, and they were worth every penny. They got quarterback money, and neither franchise has flinched once since they did it. And, you know, as I say all the time, and, you know, because Jerry Jones said it, and it's so true, you never go wrong paying a premium for a premium. It was a lot of money. They gave up multiple first-round picks. They clearly gave up a lot of money, and it's the best thing they've ever done, at least in the modern era, you know, beside, like, drafting good players. But you'll never get that opportunity again because those players never become available, ever, ever. That's just not the way the league works. As a guy told me in the league a couple years ago, he said, look at the landscape of defensive players. They always have a red flag, always. Von Miller failed the drug test, torn ACL. Jalen Ramsey never shuts up. Khalil Mack was a team captain off the field, super high character guy, and arguably him and Aaron Donald, the best two non-quarterback defensive players in the league. Like that's never going to happen. When you look at defensive players that get traded, they always have warts. They always have red flags. But this was as clean of a player as there is in the NFL. Like think about it right now. Who's the cleanest player in the NFL? It'd be Mahomes. Super high character, elite talent. If you went, who's the cleanest player, non-quarterback in the NFL? I think you might go Khalil Mack. Because it'd be him or Aaron Donald. I don't even think it's a question. And at the end of the day, in Chicago, they care about defense more than offense, so it fits the city. It fits him perfectly. He's a bright light, bright star guy. Let's call it what it is. Him and Amari were somewhat wasting away in Oakland. You know, it's one of the lowest rated franchises in terms of television ratings. It gets dwarfed here where I live by the 49ers. And both of them deserve to be in major franchises. And Amari Cooper's gone to Dallas. I mean, I don't have a NFL.com page in front of me how many total touchdowns. I know he leads the league right now in touchdowns. He has four. Now, they've played crappy teams, but he looks dominant. And he's been awesome since he got to the Cowboys. Now, that was somewhat understandable. But at the end of the day, they traded Amari Cooper. And they got, you know, they got pick 27, which turned out to be a box safety that lasted one game before his shoulder tore off. They got two first-round picks for Khalil Mack. One of them's a running back, you know. And this year, do you know that the Chicago Bears have the Oakland Raiders' second round pick this year because they did a pick swap? So the Bears, who surely look like, I don't know if they're a lock playoff team, which I felt like before the season, but they're between an 8 and a 10 win season, depending on how well Trubisky plays in some of these big games. They are in the playoff hunt. They will be in the playoff hunt till at worst mid-December. That's happening. And they have the Raiders' second round pick. You do understand that the Raiders are going to be drafting in the top five. They are putrid. So the Bears, who, yeah, they won't have their first-round pick, which will probably be somewhere between 20 and 25. They'll get the Raiders' second-round pick, which will probably be about 37. So it's not, would you do that for Khalil Mack? Every day of the week and twice on Sundays. And listen, I've defended this guy, and I've been open. I said I'm biased. He's my guy. He's my friend. But Nagy knows what he's doing. He learned he was the right-hand man for years, and he worked under him for 10-plus years, of the best offensive coach in the league. He naturally thinks like that because he's a quarterback. Now, he's playing with somewhat of an uphill battle when Mitch Trubisky's his quarterback. He wasn't there when they drafted him. He inherited the guy. Would he have been, you know, pounding the table for Mitch Trubisky? I don't know. I would doubt it. But I would say his best attribute as a person, and I think it's the way he coaches, is he's a very positive guy. And you often see coaches, you know, I think the Grudens are like this, they get very negative. They're just like, I don't want this guy, get rid of him. I don't want this guy, get rid of him. Where Nagy did not go in there thinking like that. Now, did he have the juice when he first got hired to say trade Trubisky? No, but he wouldn't have. That's not the way he thinks. And I think when you're an optimistic, glass half full offensive coach, it's easier to deal with guys. And it's easier to be more open-minded about coaching guys that you probably, in a perfect world, would not want to coach. Because let's call it is what it is, right? Matt Nagy, if he could choose, Mitch Trubisky would probably, you know, even a quarterbacks available the last couple offseason, probably wouldn't have been his pick, whether it was draft, free agency, trades, whatever. But he's doing it. And he's doing it, for the most part, kind of with a smile on his face. Where, as we see Jay Gruden during this Monday night game, looks like he's ready to jump off a bridge. He looks miserable. Now, part of that is the Washington Redskins, who are easily, you know, them, the Raiders, and the Browns, just lead the league in dysfunction. They are a disaster. Now, unlike the Raiders, who are broke, and unlike the Browns, who their owner has big-time wealth, but, you know, might have stolen it from the hardworking truck drivers of America, Dan Snyder was a business genius, and I've talked about this before. I went off on a segment a couple weeks ago. It really is crazy just how crappy they stay. And this is, to me, a franchise versus franchise game, more than like a player versus player game. You just watch the Bears are on a completely different level. Just the way they operate. You see there's a, during the Monday Night Football game, Bruce Allen, who's the GM, and basically Dan Snyder's right-hand guy, is sitting in the coach's box. Sitting in the coach's box. That would be the equivalent, let's say you're a sales guy, and whoever your boss is, like the guy that manages all the sales guys, wherever, let's say you have a sales room where a lot of you sit and make calls. It's probably a little different in 2019. Not everyone just sitting there, you know, on an old school phone making calls. But your boss would just be looking over your shoulder. Like, hey, Bruce Allen, you're a terrible general manager. You've shown over and over you are not competent at all. You can't land decent players for the life of you. And you're sitting over these coaches, which may be good, they may not be good. I'm not trying to defend their credibility, but you should not be sitting in the coaching box. You know, if John Elway wants to sit in the coaching box, yeah, I can live with that. If Ozzie Newsome had wanted to sit in the coaching box, I can live with that. If an owner wants to sit in the coaching box, I would understand he has the power, though I'd say it's not, like that's a little unfair to your employees. Bruce Allen has no business sitting in there. Sit in your own box, sit in the press box, get out of there, buddy. Because all you consistently do is you guys sign players that are bigger names, and they've been doing this basically since Dan Snyder took over the franchise, and I think Josh Norman is the best example. Every single game, Josh Norman has been getting smoke for the last 2 years. This year, he started to kind of tap out. And, you know, I'm not really that into it. And not quite, he's not fast just to begin with. He ain't running. He ain't playing. You could argue he's quitting on some plays. And you know what that's a reflection of? What are you going to do? Cut him? No, you owe him too much cash. Can't trade him. No one's trading for that contract. You constantly have guys like that on your franchise, and you wonder why you lose year in and year out. And here's the worst part about it. I really feel for fans, just diehard fans. Sports means a lot to me. Clearly, I've dedicated my life to it. If you're listening to this, it clearly means a lot to you. You're really interested in football, sports, whatever. But as a sports fan, when you're born, you're just kind of regionally tied to whatever teams around you. So you're going to, if you're born in whatever city, say the Virginia area, you're probably going to be a Redskins fan. And if you're 30 years old, for the most part, you've lived through the Dan Snyder era. Definitely of your, you know, memories that you can draw back on, it's all been Dan Snyder. It's not your fault that some clown owns your team. I say it all the time about here about the Raider fans. Can you imagine having Mark Davis as your owner? But yet you're a diehard fan? That sucks. It's why I never blame, like, you can't be a bandwagon guy and leave. Why not? It's not like you chose the ownership. You can root for players and coaches. But if your owner's crappy, your team will, for the most part, be consistently really bad. I've worked for one NFL team. And Jeffrey Lurie, clearly, when I was there, was just a high-level guy, was not hanging over people's shoulders. And when he was around, really friendly to everyone, gave everyone every resource you could possibly ask for. And now that I left and have, you know, a bigger view of the entire league, no wonder the Eagles kick everyone's ass. And they've consistently been winning now for 20-plus years. He's a big part of it. And if you asked Andy Reid or you asked Doug Peterson now, you asked Howie Roseman, it's pretty clear the advantage they have. Same with Kansas City. Look at the way Clark Hunt operates. Or look at the way Paul Allen operated forever, you know, with Pete Carroll and John Schneider. Like, ownership matters. Same thing in baseball, in basketball. It's the same thing. The Warriors sucked for my entire life. They were terrible. Joe Lacob buys the team in, like, I think 2011 or maybe early 2012, and everything flipped. You think it's random? Now, obviously, there were some variables that came into play. He inherited Steph Curry. But if you think that the Warriors, if they would have had the same owner before Joe Lacob got there, Steph Curry ever would have turned out to Steph Curry, you're out of your mind. It had no chance to succeed because you can't overcome In most organizations, I would imagine most of you guys can relate, in the, whatever business you work for, if the guy signing your check is a royal clown, either a micromanager, either lacks the funds to operate in his said business, you have no chance. None. You might have a good year or two. There may be variables on a certain quarter, or if you're a pro sports team, a certain year where things go well, but you cannot sustain success if your owner sucks. I think that is just a blanket statement in America. Dan Snyder is just a fantastic example of that. Look at the guy he's empowered to basically run his franchise. He's sitting in with the coaches, and you wonder why they always suck. Josh Norman gets cut, they immediately sign. He's been terrible since he's been there. You can go through the list of the 20-plus years of guys that have been robbing the Washington Redskins. Absolutely robbing them. And that's an indictment of the owner. And you look at, I don't know much about Virginia McCaskey. I don't know if she's doing that much. But they finally hired some credible people. And knowing people in Chicago, they let them operate. They're pretty smart. Now, they're a little slower than, let's say, a Jerry Jones or, you know, a Robert Kraft or a Jeffrey Lurie that are really aggressive. That's not really the Bears' MO. But they definitely just, they will hire the right person. And then if you prove that you're, you know, credible, they'll let you roll with it. Like, Dan Snyder is always involved. Everyone, at the time of I'm recording it, there's 11 minutes left in the third quarter. The Bears just picked him off again. My Twitter timeline is saying over and over and over, time to put Dwayne Haskins in, time to put Dwayne Haskins in. It is not time to put Dwayne Haskins in. You are playing the best defensive line in football. You will get him killed. That is not fair to Dwayne Haskins at all. Now, by the time that I finish this segment and this game's still got a long way to go, he may be in and he may get killed. And that would be another blunder by the Washington Redskins. But Case Keenum has to die for the sins of the franchise right now, because you can't put Haskins in against this team. Okay, let's get into Danny Dimes, which, let's just call it what it is an outstanding nickname. I have no clue who came up with it or where it started. I actually saw it for the first time on Sunday, just on Twitter, and it's incredible. Danny Dimes, a.k.a. Daniel Jones, the number 6 overall pick for the New York Giants. Great nickname. But let's start, before we kind of dive into the game, which I just saw bits and highlights during the day Sunday, and then once all the games ended, I watched it on my iPad. The NFL, the app, has these great condensed games. You know, Game Pass, I think a lot of people think, is like the All-22 tape. If you're an NFL fan, and I'm sure many people listening know about this, I've been using it for years since I've been in the media. The best way I watch games is I go to the NFL app and I watch condensed games. So I can watch a television broadcast of every game now in the NFL in like between 30 and 45 minutes. And for this show, because, you know, it's really hard to watch more than one game at one time. You know, I think a lot of people say they do it, but it's difficult to do it. And I'm at the point, like, I'm not breaking down X's and O's in terms of, like, individual players, all 22. Those days are done for me. But I can watch a television copy of a game and get the information I need for the entertainment standpoint, which is this. So we'll dive into what I saw with Danny Dimes. But I said it last week on Friday, the last show, that there was a lot of former players, and I understand former players are usually like-minded people, and especially Eli's teammates that were freaking out over him getting benched and thought he was getting a raw deal. One thing is clear, Eli, it wasn't all on Eli. The Giants defense, and as you saw versus Tampa Bay, and I played on Daily Fantasy, heavy Jameis, Mike Evans, who had just had a monster day, their defense is terrible. So it's not all Eli. But the number one thing the NFL has going for it, and it's why the property of the NFL has never been more valuable, it's why individual teams have never been more valuable, it's not because of the caliber of football. That's, I got news for you, it's kind of, you know, meaningless. It doesn't really matter. People are like, oh, I can't watch this product. Well, actually, you can. Because the NFL is all about attention. And anything media-wise, really, the NFL is a television product. That's where they make the majority of their cash now, is about keeping your attention. No different than what I'm doing here. I'm trying to get more and more people to listen to this. Can I keep your attention? That's the business model. The more people that listen, the more you charge, more money you make. The more people that watch the NFL, the more they are able to sell their television rights to these different networks. That's how they make the majority of their cash. That's why the business is such a lucrative proposition. Do you understand that in the other two major sports, baseball and basketball, some of their teams don't generate that much money, if anything at all? Where in the NFL, because of revenue sharing, and even baseball, that revenue shared forever, meaning if you were just one of the partners, one of the teams, you got a check. And in baseball, it was if you were a low revenue team, like the Oakland A's. The irony is they've never been a low, you know, small market team. They're a low budget team. They're actually owners worth billions of dollars. They've just been a low rev team. And the teams like the Yankees and the Giants and the Dodgers cut them a check. Well, baseball wiped that out. Where in football, you could have, it's pretty clear which teams move the needle and generate big television ratings. The Cowboys, the Patriots, the Eagles, the Packers, the Steelers. When the Niners are good, the Niners. Like, it's not as many teams as you think. The Chiefs now, they've been good for a while. The NFC East is big. I mean, even the shitty Giants generate the money. Like, Mark Davis gets this $275 million check. He's one of the lowest rated teams in the country, and he doesn't play any primetime games. But he's a partner in this thing they call the National Football League, so he gets a big, you know, check like every other owner. Jerry Jones gets the same check. Now, those guys make money in other avenues. But the number one thing you have to do to keep people's attention is either be good. That's probably the goal for every team. Just be good and competitive, and people will watch. Whether you're in LA, whether you're in Green Bay, it doesn't matter where you are. If you're good, people will care in any sport, but more than ever in football. But if you're bad, you have to sell something. You know, do we have a rookie quarterback? Do we have a new coach? Are we doing something that's kind of fun? And it's why that when Eli's teammates last week, and I get it, they're his boys, freaked out, they were somewhat misguided. The reason the Giants made the move was because they needed something for their fans. And I say this all the time. The business, every dollar in pro sports, whether you own a team, whether you're a player, whether you're someone like me in the media, whether you're a coach, all comes from the fans. That's where all this money is generated. Every penny that a team generates is fan-driven. Whether it's your naming rights, why do you think someone's willing to pay you $20, $30 million a year to put it on a building? Because a lot of people talk about it. Because a lot of people see it. Because of fans. If there wasn't any fans, no one would pay any of this money. People want to be involved with something a lot of people watch or talk about. That's marketing 101, right? So the Giants needed to kind of breathe some life into what was becoming kind of apathetic around their franchise. The Giants were a terrible watch. If Saquon Barkley was not handed the football, they've become unwatchable the last couple years. So going to Danny Dimes breathed some life into their fan base. It made Sunday, before you knew he was good or bad, interesting. Which, if Eli had started the game, someone like me, I wouldn't mention this game at all. I would not have cared. I wouldn't have watched one snap. That game would have been irrelevant. To watch another Eli performance, who actually can still throw the ball, he just can't move. And the Giants' offensive line is terrible. So if your offensive line is terrible, you have to be somewhat athletic to avoid some of these hits. There's never been more pass rushers in the league. There are more pass rushers coming in the league these last 5 to 10 years than are good offensive linemen. It's basic supply and demand. So you're seeing better pass rushers because there's not as good offensive line. And Eli can't move. So insert Danny Dimes. I don't regret being hard on Dave Gettleman during the draft. Because I'm pretty confident, even looking back, how would Danny Dimes not have been there at 17? And their defense, which is probably through 3 games, I don't have the stat in front of me, I'd imagine, maybe there were some bad Giants teams before my lifetime. I mean, I was born in 1984. I know they went through some probably lean years in the 70s, and even the early 80s before Parcells got there. But for the most part, in my life of consuming football, the Giants have been kind of a defensive team. They've had good defenses. Now, some years have been worse than others, but they've been a defensive-heavy team. So imagine if they would have drafted, let's say, Josh Allen at 6 overall and Danny Dimes 17. Now, ultimately, if Danny Dimes becomes this Hall of Famer, did they do the right thing? Yeah. But you can't tell me, because the draft is a stock market. It's not necessarily about, you know, this guy's going to be a Hall of Famer. Well, if you can get that same Hall of Famer in the 3rd round, you don't need to take him in the 1st round. And just look back, the 2 teams that they were probably scared of most of taking Daniel Jones. We'll call him Daniel Jones just so you know who I'm talking about. It was the Washington Redskins. Well, their owner loved Dwayne Haskins, so they were not going to take Daniel Jones. And then John Elway, who clearly has just a love and a desire to have big arm quarterbacks. And look who we took, Drew Lock. Look who we traded for, Joe Flacco. Doesn't mean they're good, but Danny Dimes, he's more of an accurate, he's like a better version of Alex Smith. He's athletic, he's accurate, he has a good arm. I wouldn't call him have a great arm, but it's definitely good enough. And back when you used to say Alex Smith like 6 or 7 years ago, people thought you were saying a bad thing. Alex Smith was really good. If that's what Danny Dimes becomes, the Giants would be in pretty good shape. And this guy probably has a little more alive of an arm. But I'm hesitant to do this because we've seen so many times when you just watch one game or even like a month of games and you go, this guy's the next great quarterback. For the most part, like Mahomes, we knew Mahomes was special after his first game at the end of his rookie year. You just watch that, you're like, whoa, this doesn't really look like anything. But then he had an entire season, threw 50 touchdowns and won the MVP. It's hard to discount, this guy might be the best player in the league. And then he's come back, and there's no way you could even argue that. Even Carson Wentz, he's had some injuries. But if you just watch Carson, you don't need to look at a box score. You go, that guy doesn't look like most other quarterbacks. Same with Deshaun Watson, and same with several young quarterbacks. But Baker Mayfield, as I'll talk about later on the show, was a guy that short, small sample size has kind of been punk so far this year. So it's hard to maintain and sustain playing in the NFL at a high level, week in, week out, the more and more film that gets out on you. But through one game, and that's all we can judge Danny Dimes on, he was fantastic. Watching the game, he made some gorgeous throws, but the number one thing that stood out to me was just how cool, calm, and collected he was. You know, I'm watching other quarterbacks yesterday, like, for example, Derek Carr, who's in year 7, who freaks out in the pocket. I watched Baker Mayfield, who started several games, freaks out in the pocket. Danny Dimes, just sitting there. Pressure's coming, pressure's not coming. He kind of looks the same. And then his accuracy really stood out. He looks like a really good quarterback. And if you've been listening to me for a long time, you know after the draft, one thing that I was told by a bunch of NFL scouts is a lot of people, or the people that I knew in the South that did the SEC and Duke's in that region, even though they're not, they're in the ACC, but you get, you know, the Carolinas down to like Alabama, you kind of have that region, maybe Mississippi. I don't have a map in front of me, but you know, have those SEC states and then a couple of those ACC states. People liked Daniel Jones. They thought he was like a fringe first round pick. I know people that had first round grades on him. I think there's a difference between thinking the guy's a fringe first rounder, a guy you'd feel comfortable taking in the late 20s, like an Aaron Rodgers or Lamar Jackson, you know, that kind of range where they went, and taking a guy 6th overall, especially when you have a guy whose resume in Dave Gettleman that's fair to question. It really is. And Pat Shurmur is so arrogant when he gets in front of a microphone, you know, like he's know-all, be-all. Like, Pat, we've seen you be a head coach so far, and it's been an utter train wreck disaster. So let's just be a little humble, like your starting quarterback and your backup quarterback, and just see how this thing plays out. Yeah, it was a really good win. In Daniel Jones, once he has the game-winning drive where he runs in the touchdown, to me, that's the big number that stood out. He threw 2 touchdowns. Evan Engram had some just highlight plays, just some wow moments. Just were incredible. Evan Engram's a star. And probably the most impressive part about the game is Saquon Barkley goes out, I'm pretty sure early or midway through the second quarter, but for the majority of the game, especially as they're coming back in the second half, Saquon Barkley's not on the field. So that makes it even more impressive that this guy was unaffected by their best player and easily their best playmaker going out and just starts making plays and puts them in a position to win the game. Now, ultimately, a kicker missed a short field goal after the defense, again, gave up another major pick, or excuse me, a long pass down the sideline to Mike Evans. But that's out of the quarterback's control. The quarterback played a high-level game, winning football in his first start. Now, can he keep rattling this off? Time will tell. But no one will argue, especially no one in the NFL, if you just throw on that game where you just don't go, wow, this guy's really impressive. And I think more than ever, you have to have some athletic ability. Because back to what I was saying about the offensive linemen. There are so many good pass rushers, and offensive linemen are consistently getting beat like drums on every team, even the good ones. You have to be able to move around. Unless you're Tom Brady and you just constantly get rid of the ball so fast because you know the offense like, you know, the alphabet. It's just you couldn't know the offense any better. I don't even know the offense like an alphabet. You get what I'm saying. Tom Brady's football genius of their own offense. No one knows it better, probably including Belichick and Josh McDaniels. So he's just operating on a higher level. And Danny Dimes can really move. Obviously, he had the 2 rushing touchdowns, but you just see it behind the pocket. And I give quarterbacks credit that keep plays alive behind the line of scrimmage without, you don't need to be Lamar Jackson necessarily or Kyler Murray to take off. You can be a great player by keeping plays alive just outside of the tackle box, keeping your eyes downfield and looking to throw. And I thought that's what Daniel Jones did a really good job of. He never looked super flustered, which is really impressive. He's clearly a high-level guy. He's clearly a really smart player from Duke. So I think you'd give his opening debut start an A or an A+. I probably couldn't have gotten much better. You'd say, well, they won. Yeah, they kind of got lucky for the win. I don't even factor in the win or loss to his performance. His performance in a vacuum was high level. It was exceptional. Now, can he keep that up? We'll see. It's going to be difficult. They clearly play in hostile environments. The New York media slash fan base can turn on you like Danny Dimes in a dime. So you got to be very, very excited if you're a New York Giants fan, and you should be. But this notion that like Dave Gettleman deserves some apology or something right now still seems a little crazy. And Albert Breer, who I really like, I saw him during training camp, he tweeted something this morning. He thought it was kind of groupthink on Twitter. I really don't believe that. I think it was simple, at least from anyone with common sense, was, Dave, you did not need to draft him at 6. And you ended up taking a nose tackle where you could have got Josh Allen and had Danny Dimes. Because I don't think they would have taken as much heat if they had taken Danny Dimes at 17. Which is, again, where they could have got him. You know, you couldn't have gotten Kyler Murray at 3. Like, he was going number one in this draft no matter what. The year Wentz and Goff, like, those guys were going really high. To me, Danny Dimes, like, part of what makes the Baltimore Ravens pick a Lamar Jackson so great is they understood the market. They didn't have to trade up and get him at, like, 12. They knew they could get him at the end of the first round. Once upon a time, the Minnesota Vikings did that with Teddy Bridgewater. That's what makes a really fantastic pick for a guy that's not going super high. Now, at the end of the day, like I said, if he just has a Hall of Fame career, no one will really remember that, right? It'll be, all right, they took him at 6, they should have. But I will, and I'm not changing my tune on that one just quite yet. Okay, let's dive into the Eagles. And the older you get, the wisdom you get when you're young is just be prepared for anything. Crazy things happen. And you're young, you're like, okay, yeah, whatever. And then as you get older, and I'm about to be 35 in a couple weeks, experienced a lot of crazy shit over the last 10 years, you know? Been fired a couple times, didn't expect it to happen. One time I did. This year, for example, on my other podcast, we had a big sponsor that just all of a sudden went bankrupt. So I'm just like, okay, when's my the big check that you owe me coming? And they're like, well, we're in bankruptcy. And you're like, what? And I'm sure many people listening to this who are in all sorts of different business, the number one thing you learn in any business, right, is expect the unexpected because things change. You never know what's coming on a daily basis. Just what makes life so crazy makes it somewhat hard, right? The best companies, the best individual people, the most successful teams can handle crazy things. And sometimes crazy shit happens. And in football, the crazy shit that you can't really expect are injuries. Injuries happen. Now, you hope they happen to players that aren't as important as others. Clearly, if your star quarterback gets hurt, you're screwed. But other positions, like if your starting left tackle goes down, if your best player on defense goes down, it's a problem. But what if your top two targets on offense go down? Some of your best, you know, your big free agent acquisition goes down. You got to be able to adapt. But it's kind of hard. And sometimes young players are thrust into positions they're not ready for. I've watched the Philadelphia Eagles game against the Detroit Lions, and I was pretty impressed. I think Carson Wentz is playing really, really well. There's just so much you can do. I'm getting DMs from people that are like, Howie drafted JJ and Miles Sanders, and they are not producing at a high enough level. Well, I don't think they expected JJ Arcega-Whiteside to have to play this much this fast. DeSean Jackson got hurt. Alshon Jeffrey got hurt. Their backup tight end, who plays a lot, Goddard, has been banged up. Like, there's only so much you can do. Malik Jackson, who they signed at a relatively, really cheap deal, boom, gone for the season. Tim Jernigan, right? Is he hurt too? They just lose a lot of bodies. You can only account for so many bodies. Like, even if you got Carson Wentz, who to me looks fantastic, there's only so much you can do. I came away from the Eagles game yesterday kind of impressed. Their best offensive weapon right now by a mile is Nelson Aguilar. And if you watch the funny clip about the dude that saved the babies from the fire, he even made fun of Nelson Aguilar in a time of tragedy. Also, that speaks to how important the NFL is. A guy in a time of tragedy is thinking about Nelson Aguilar's drops. Luckily, he didn't drop the babies, unlike Nelson Aguilar dropped the footballs. But Nelson Aguilar had 2 touchdowns. So, you can't make the playoffs in September. But sometimes you cannot make the playoffs in September. In the sense of, you start 0-4, 0-5, you're in trouble. Now, we saw last year the Colts were able to overcome it. It's hard to call must-win games for talented teams before, like, November. But this is a massive game for the Eagles on Thursday night. And like I said, crazy stuff happens. You don't control your schedule as an NFL team. So it turns out they have this crazy rash of injuries. They're playing a Lions team, which is actually much improved. And then it turns out they have a Thursday night game that happens to be in week 4. You know, it's just the cards you're dealt. And you just gotta overcome it. And that's the great part about just our society. It's a pretty black and white society. It's a great part about capitalism. You either make money or you don't. You know, you either run successful companies or you don't. In football, you either win or you don't. Like, if you lose, you're a loser. You know, and there's no tougher place to play in Philly. But I do think you can kind of take a step back and go, we are playing with, you know, a gun that's only half loaded. Luckily, our gun is just led by a coach that has looked Belichick in the face and beat him in the biggest game with his backup quarterback. A star quarterback who is playing really well. Like, to me, Carson Wentz's game just jumps off the television screen right now. I think he's playing at an elite level. Like, he can't catch the ball for the wide receivers. But he's also throwing it for guys that a month ago they didn't know they were going to depend on. And that's part of why Doug makes a lot of money and their coaching staff is so highly thought of around the league. You got to get these guys up to speed. And I think sometimes the thing that people don't understand, just the casual fan, is when you have a major injury to a guy like Alshon Jeffrey and he starts missing games, well, Alshon Jeffrey has just taken so many reps and is such a big part of the plan all August that a guy like Ortega Whiteside is running with 2s and 3s and who isn't a big part of in the huddle with the 1s. Now, they get thrust into it because it's just the next man up mentality, but sometimes it takes a minute. Hell, sometimes Nelson Aguilar is a good example. He wasn't even good for like the first 3 years of his career. Not everyone. Like, you can be a good player in the NFL and not have it figured out till 2 or 3 or 4 years into your career. Look at Dante Fowler. Gets traded from the Jags last year and has like been a completely different human. So, I just think the Eagles, they're at one of those times in their franchise where a lot of shit went wrong. And they've actually adapted as well as you possibly can. I mean, 2 weeks ago, it took a 4th-and-4 wide receiver screen to one of the best wide receivers we've ever seen to beat them. On the road, when they had multiple guys go down in pregame warm-ups. Not during the game, in pregame warm-ups. Think how crazy that is. So I've actually learned more about the Eagles. I know it was a tough loss last night, but or yesterday, if you're listening to this a couple days ago, but I actually came away pretty impressed. And again, back to Carson, the number one thing you have to have in this league to really be a player and why the Eagles are going to be a factor this year if they can just get one or two of these guys back is because that guy is so freaking good. I say it all the time. There's under 30 guys. There's Mahomes, or as they say in the State Farm commercial, Mahomey. You got Mahomey at the top. I think this guy is the clear next guy, and I don't even know if there's anyone close to his level. I like Deshaun Watson, but he ain't that. Jared Goff clearly ain't that. Baker Mayfield, let's pump the brakes on him. Jimmy G, no. Derek Carr is not even in the conversation anymore. So, you know, Lamar Jackson had 70 yards through 3 quarters at Arrowhead. So let's pump the brakes a little there, too. That I think the Eagles are going to be okay. Everyone in Philly needs to take a deep breath. I get you freak out, and I think it's awesome. What I love about Philly, the standards are high, sky high. It's about winning every week. There are only a couple markets that once they know they have a good team, like that's the expectation, and it should be. That's what happens when you have Carson Wentz. That's the way I've been around. That's the way Howie thinks. Jeffrey Lurie, these are the highest level, you know, beside like New England, there's high level of an organization as you're going to get. I'm telling you, I think they're going to be okay. But I won't discount that this game Thursday night is pretty must win. You know, got the Cowboys who are 3-0 or look like destined to be a 12-win team. The other thing you got to think if you're Philly is being a wild card team, probably going to have to take, you know, 10 wins to get there. So if you start 2-2, it's much easier to get 10 wins than 1-3. So this is a big game, but I have faith in the Birds. Okay, let's get into the tale of two coaches. And, you know, coaching's clearly a really, really hard profession, right? It takes the time these guys spend in the office. I've seen it firsthand, college and pro. You make a lot of money, but you really work. You know, you spend a lot of time on your craft. It's not your typical job. You're also paid a lot of money. I mean, assistant coaches in this league, in the NFL and in college, you know, are making huge cash. $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, like coach running backs. You know, the offensive line coach making $1 million. I don't feel sorry. No one does in this country. That's not the way society works. But they do work, spend a lot of time and away from their families, and earn the cash at least through effort. Now, not all of them are good, I promise you. And I mean, if you're listening to this, you know, not all coaches are created equal. But I saw two guys this weekend, and I think it's the tale of two men. One, and I think in coaching in general, experience, just like with players, does experience really matter? I think it helps in certain situations, but you're either physically gifted enough or you're not. Like, if I put the ball in your hands in a position, can you make a play or not? But most things in life, like coaching, like normal jobs, you get better with time. And Kyle Shanahan, who I had anointed, like most people, as one of the best offensive minds in the league, and I thought he was going to be a star head coach. And even after he had two straight seasons of drafting in the top 10, he was still considered, if they had some hypothetical coaching draft, he would have been a top pick. And I said the one thing about this season is he needed to prove himself. But the one thing that I always was impressed on with Kyle, when things went really poorly, as they did his first two seasons, he handled it pretty well. And he was good with the media in the sense that when he would come after losses, he was wearing it on his face. But I never saw him snap. And I think he was in a position when he got the head coaching job. One, he's a pretty unique human, right? He was born into a family whose dad was one of the best offensive minds we've ever seen. And then was a head coach for countless years. Won Super Bowls. Like, was a pretty famous guy. Now, sometimes just being around it doesn't equate to make you successful, but you're around it, you have a front row seat, and then he got into coaching immediately in college and was coaching, boom, right off the bat, became a GA at Texas, right up until he became an offensive coordinator, I think in his late 20s, and go back and Google some of those Houston teams where he was the coordinator on, they were pretty damn good. Now, was Kubiak calling plays? I'd have to go Google that, but I'm pretty sure Kyle played a big role and Kubiak would tell you that. And they had the best offensive running game in the NFL. So this guy, at a very young age, and he probably got the benefit of the doubt because of his last name. If his last name had been Middlecoff, does he become an offensive coordinator that early? No. But he took advantage of a situation. He's clearly really bright and grinded and then left with his two, become the offensive coordinator for his dad, and then bounced around a little bit, had a lot of experience. So even when he was hired to be the 49er head coach, however old he was at the time when he was hired, 37, 38, whatever it was, he had had a lot of experience. Like I've said with McVay, McVay was hired at 31 years old, but he had been coaching the moment he left in college. Now, that's still at warp speed, but it's not like he had been coaching for a couple years, a former player or anything. This guy started coaching. Sometimes when you're a shitty player and you know you want to get into coaching, it helps because when you're 21, 22 years old, you just start, you know, where some of these guys, these former players, where maybe they play till they're 27, 28, even if they have a shorter career, they've made a little cash, they might not get into it till they're 31, 32, or whatever. So Kyle Shanahan was able to handle two first years of things not going very well. And I was always really impressed. One, every game Kyle Shanahan coaches, he has a couple moments. If you're sitting on your couch or you're at the game where you go, whoa, oh, wow, didn't see that, whoa. Well, that makes you do that. And that's what a good offensive coach does. It's what Andy Reid does. It's what Josh McDaniels does. It's what Sean Payton does. It's what Sean McVay has done throughout his career. It's what good offensive coaches do. And Kyle is consistent at it. So I always thought he's a really good offensive coordinator, but there's more to being a head coach than being the offensive coordinator. Well, this year he's got a team that's pretty damn good. And they're winning games that aren't always pretty. So far right now they're 3-0. Now they haven't really played anyone, but clearly they've gotten a lot better. So I've kind of been validated that I anointed Kyle Shanahan as one of the top coaches in the NFL. Yeah, he just needed some better players, but he was equipped because of the experience. And we knew he had a long resume of calling plays. We knew he could at least do one thing well. He's continued to do that well as a head coach. And clearly the players on his team like him, they rally around him, and they play hard for him. That was the other thing. Even when they were getting smoked in last year when Jimmy G tore his ACL, and even the year before when before Jimmy G got there and Brian Hoyer was the coach, the one thing the 49ers consistently did under Kyle Shanahan, win or lose, was play their ass off. And I think all you guys know, if you've been watching football a long time, that is not just some guarantee for any team, right? Just playing hard. Where I think if you look on the flip side, Freddie Kitchens, who last night gave a press conference, or a couple nights ago, I guess if you're listening to this on Tuesday or Wednesday, while he was chewing gum. And I'm going to sound a little bit like my dad, but it was one of the worst looks I've ever seen. He looked like a slob. And yeah, he's got the bright red face, kind of looks, you know, like a big drinker. Let's call it what it is. That's usually what a big-time drinker looks like, at that red face. Freddie Kitchens ain't that old. His body clearly shows that he might be throwing him back. But I know a lot of functional people that drink a lot. So I'm not even judging you there. And definitely a lot of football coaches over the years have been big drinkers. But he'd never been an offensive coordinator up until midway through last season when the Browns literally fired everyone in their building that could call plays. So Freddie Kitchens gets the job with limited experience as a play caller. So part of the reason you're hiring him, because he's not like some rah-rah Harbaugh, right? He's never proven to be some Belichick just because you kind of liked him. And everyone around the league were like, well, John Dorsey, big ego guy, he wants someone he can control. Now you're seeing Freddie Kitchens, things aren't going quite as planned. One, because he doesn't have experience calling plays like guys like Kyle had. So even when they got their experience and there is some learning on the job, Kyle can always resort back to, I know how to do this when they do this because I've done it for 10 years. I know how to do this when they do this. Or when they do this, I can do this. Freddie doesn't have any of that. He's never called plays up until last season. He's clearly over his head. He looks like a slob. Last night he's telling the reporters, like, you can write an article, blame it all on me. You know, is that Southern draw? And don't get me wrong, I love the South. So I'm not making fun of the Southern draw. It's just one of the only accents that I do well. You can put it all on me. I'm the coach. Yeah, Freddie, we are going to put it on you. You ran a draw on 4th and 9 in the fourth quarter of a game against the defending NFC champs. You're an idiot. That was one of the most moronic things we've ever seen. But why should we be shocked? The guy has zero experience. The guy is clearly in over his head. The guy has no clue what he's doing. The quarterback's getting worse. The offense looks discombobulated. It's a disaster. It really is. I said this last week after the Monday night game, even when they beat the crap out of the Jets, they didn't even look good then. Like, this team is, the way they're playing right now, they have no shot. They don't have a snowball's chance in hell to make the playoffs if things don't dramatically improve. And I don't see how you could feel confident if you're a Browns fan, or definitely if you're like a Ravens fan, you're like, thank God Freddie Kitchens is the coach. Because with guys like McVay, guys like Kyle, even say what you want, I got the Arizona Cardinals game in the background. I don't think Cliff Kingsbury is a very good NFL head coach, or he's proven to be a good coach at all throughout his career as a head coach. But at least you know he does one thing well. He can call plays. He can scheme up some plays. Whether they work or not, he can resort to things he's done in the past. Freddie can't. So the most basic level, you see all this pressure now mounting because the Browns had all these expectations which were out of whack to begin with, and he's kind of freaking out. He has no clue what to do. Of course he's freaking out. You and I would freak out if we're put in situations that we have zero experience in. That's a normal human reaction. Part of the reason I think, looking back, why Kyle hadn't freaked out, he's like, well, I know I'm a really good play caller. So if I can just figure some other things out on the team, I know I'm going to be able to do that well. Like, what does Freddie Kitchens, when he sits there on his office Monday through Saturday, go, you know what, this is what I do well. And I think if he's being honest with himself, there's nothing. There really isn't. And what's crazy, this guy was a former quarterback at Alabama, and he just comes off kind of like a bumbling idiot. He really does. And it's an embarrassing look. And I thought last night chewing the gum in the postgame press conference was a sight to behold. It was like, ugh. They went on SportsCenter from Freddie Kitchens to Sean McVay. It was like watching, these guys are in the same industry, let alone these guys have the same position in the industry. It was an eye-opening experience just sitting there on my couch and just randomly flipping the channels. Oh, I'm like, oh, Freddie Kitchens, press conference on it. I'm going to watch this. And then it clipped over right to Sean McVay. It was like watching one guy that runs a Fortune 500 CEO and the other guy that runs like a mom-and-pop sandwich shop. You're like, yeah, no wonder the guy in the blue won the game. Okay, let's get into Jim Harbaugh and the disaster that was Saturday morning for me in Madison, Wisconsin. Jump around, baby. I actually went when I was at Fresno State. We played them. Place is badass. It's an awesome place to play. And Harbaugh got his ass kicked. There's no way around it. That's a fact. You know, if you watched, hell, the game was over at first half. It was kind of like the Monday Night Football game. But the final score didn't even get as close to Monday Night. They got demolished. And I think we've probably always overreacted. Like in the 60s, people were getting mad when Mickey Mantle was striking out or Joe Namath was throwing an interception. If you watching it at your house or you were at the game, just no one could see it. Now, whether it's me, whether it's you, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, TikTok, I don't even know what TikTok is. I just think all the kids are talking about it. That's where people react now, and you feel everyone's experience. So on Twitter, on social media, Twitter's like where I live during games, it was Harbaugh's the village idiot. He is the village idiot. And there is no arguing that he hasn't quite lived up to expectations. He's 0-4 versus Ohio State. That's probably his biggest issue. And he hasn't really competed for a national title. And when they hired Jim Harbaugh, let's not forget, he was just a free agent because the Niners were moving off him. He chose them. Obviously, they desperately wanted him, but he chose them. And people act like it's been a complete failure at Michigan. And that Harbaugh almost is like some media creation. And to me, a media creation is like John Gruden. John Gruden's this quarterback guru. Check his resume. He's had one good quarterback in the last 25 years. And granted, he took 10 years off. And it was a 34-year-old Rich Gannon. He's not a quarterback guru. He had a quarterback show on ESPN for 10 years that was fun to watch. But he's not a quarterback. I mean, Derek Carr's getting worse and worse. He's not a quarterback guru. That, to me, Chip Kelly is this innovative, you know, generational coach. Well, that's looking like a media creation now. Though, Chip at least backed it up for a little bit at Oregon. When it comes to Jim Harbaugh, since 2009, let me read you something. I'm going to call it his win-loss record. This is starting at Stanford, going all the way up until right now. 8-5, 12-1, 13-3, 11-5, 11-4, 8-8, 10-3, 10-3, 8-5, 10-3, and currently 2-1. And the main numbers there is 10-3, 10-3, 8-5, 10-3, 2-1. At Michigan, they would have liked a 13-1 season, right? A playoff year. So that no way around that. It's been a disappointment. In San Francisco, when he by far had his most success, he went to 3 straight NFC championships. He went to a Super Bowl. So meaning he won an NFC and he won the division. He won the division twice. Like he's accomplished a lot. And he went to a BCS game when he was at Stanford. But one of his problems right now is the coaching turnover for him is big. And the one thing Jim Harbaugh, like his brother John Harbaugh, are very dependent. They're good coaches, but they're very dependent on their staff. At the end of the day, Sean Payton, Andy Reid, Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, when all else fails, they can call the offense. Whether they want to give the play calling duties away, whether they want to keep them, ideally, if I'm hiring all those guys, I want them to call plays. But they have the ability at any moment's notice, if they are not doing it, to immediately return to form and call the plays. So that separates them from, you know, the Harbaughs are motivators. And they're great at it. Their resumes speak for themselves. John's won a Super Bowl. Jim's never won a title, but he's been a damn good coach for a long period of time. But they're a little rah-rah-y. They're leading you into battle. They are dependent on their offensive and their defensive coordinator. And right now, Jim Harbaugh, as someone told me this offseason, because I said, God, what's up with this guy named Josh Gattis? This person from Alabama that was getting all this hype on the internet, I didn't know anything about. He was Alabama's wide receiver coach. Jim Harbaugh hired him within 5 hours of talking to him on the phone. Never met the guy. And to criticize Jim bragged about that in the media, because as I've heard, this guy's a big-time self-promoter. And part of it now is coaching has become such a big business. Because like I said, they make so much money. You can be a running back coach in the SEC and make $450,000. You're a coordinator in the league, you're making $1.5 million. You're an offensive coordinator at Michigan. This guy is. He's 35 years old. He's making $1 million a year. Well, if you're the guy's agent and you're getting 5% of that, you just do the math. You got 10 clients that are offensive coordinators in college football. It's a big business. So it's an agent-run now business, just like with players, but with coaches. The thing with players, if I'm a general manager of a team, I can watch you on tape and know exactly what you do. It becomes more difficult with coaches, especially coaches that I'm elevating from position coach to coordinator. And for in Harbaugh's success in San Francisco, he had Greg Roman and he had Brad Sealy and he had Vic Fangio the entire time. Look who his defensive coordinator's been at Michigan. He's had the same guy the entire time. Now, granted, they didn't look good on Saturday, but for the most part, they've been a defensive-led team. Don Brown, I think is his name. The old guy was in All or Nothing on Amazon, was fantastic. He's been really good. They've had consistency on that side of the ball. Well, on offense, they have not. And he just hired a guy that, from what I've heard, has no clue what he's doing. And then you watch the game for 2 weeks in a row now, Army and Wisconsin, it was clear. Because here's what he went up against. Jim Leonard. You know what Jim Leonard is not? A self-promoter. You know what Jim Leonard is? A veteran football guy. Played in the league for a while. And he was the favorite player of one of the best X's and O's defensive coaches in the league at the time, in Rex Ryan. He was Rex's guy. And then right when he got done playing, he became a coach. And now he's been a coordinator for several years at Wisconsin. And he's been kicking ass and taking names. And it's pretty clear, like, you just Google it, they're not getting the same caliber player that, like, Michigan, Ohio State gets. Yet their defense is on that level. Why? Because he's an elite coach. So when you put an elite coach against a coach that has no clue what they're doing, that's what you get on Saturday morning, Wisconsin, Michigan. Now, it's because Jim Harbaugh's not calling the plays. Now, he is responsible for the entire program. He hired Josh Gattis. So you can crush him for that. Like, his downfall this season could be hiring Josh Gattis, and that could lead to 7 or 8 wins, which would be a down year for him. Now, does he fire Josh Gattis? Sure. Is he going to be dependent on the next guy he hires? Same thing. Rinse, wash, repeat. If that guy's really good, he'll have a chance. If he's average, he won't. So that would be the question mark on Jim, and that would probably separate him. Like, at the end of the day, Saban knows everything you need to know about defense. Dabo Swinney clearly knows offense, right? I don't know if he even necessarily calls the offensive plays. I don't think he does. But the one thing that Dabo's elite at is recruiting wide receivers because he's a wide receiver coach, and that's been a separating factor over the years for Clemson. But Jim has hung his hat on motivation, and at that level, when you're trying to beat the best of the best, I mean, Jim Leonard could easily be a defensive coordinator in the NFL. Hell, Jim Leonard might be an NFL coach in like 5 years. He might be a head coach in college next year if he wants to be. He already could have been. He surely turned down jobs. You have to have high-level coaching. And if you want to criticize Jim for not being some scheme, offensive X's and O's guy, go ahead. But he's never been that. And his resume speaks for itself. All he does is win. He made a terrible hire, and it's going to be probably the downfall of this season. But acting like Jim Harbaugh is just some village idiot and he doesn't know what he's doing, it's just not true. Because we know you get judged on one thing as a head coach, wins and losses. You either win or you don't. And Jim Harbaugh, everywhere he's gone, has won. Now, has he won at a high enough level to make everyone happy at Michigan? No. Is he going to be able to? Like, do I envision, when I close my eyes, Jim Harbaugh holding up a national championship trophy at Michigan? At this point in time, probably not. I don't. Because one downfall so far for Jim Harbaugh is he also kind of got anointed as this quarterback guru. And the one thing he's done a very, very poor job of at Michigan is finding quarterbacks. And he should have somewhat the pick of the litter at Michigan. He's Jim Harbaugh. He's super famous. He was coming from San Francisco. And he just has swung and missed. He went and got the Shea Patterson character from Ole Miss. And I get that he was good at Ole Miss, but he looks like he should be playing at Nevada. You know, he's got Christian McCaffrey's brother, who I don't think's that good because he can't beat out Shea Patterson. Like, you eventually got to go find Jacob Eason. Tua. Something, Justin Herbert, something. Not what, you know, Trevor Lawrence. Go recruit one of these guys that can change your franchise. Because even though college football is probably a little bit less about X's and O's and definitely more about talent, when you see when these games get to the playoffs, when it's Oklahoma against Clemson, when it's Alabama against Clemson, when it's Georgia against Alabama, when it's Michigan, Ohio State, when all the players are relatively equal, it becomes an NFL game. And right now Harbaugh, his X's and O's clearly aren't good enough, but his players aren't either. And his quarterback is nowhere up to par. So yeah, Harbaugh is not coming through because we expected championships. And that might not even happen. But to act like Harbaugh is just some scrub coach, that to me seems a little hot takey and just a little factually incorrect. Now, this is a long podcast. We just had so much to talk about, and there's so many things I was fired up on that I had to touch on. I'm going to get into this last topic, and then we'll get into the Middlecoff mailbag. And that's how we'll end the show. But before we get into the Middlecoff mailbag, I just wanted to talk briefly because I try to watch the majority of games before I do this podcast. You know, I watch Thursday night game, obviously, and then multiple games Sunday. But it's really difficult to watch them all at once. Anyone that says they're doing that is lying. I mean, you physically can if you have 10 TVs or whatever, but it's impossible to keep up with everything. So usually on Monday morning, I've kind of got a routine. I've been doing this for years anyway, but just I try to watch like four or five of the games that I'm interested in, and now, you know, the Cowboys, Eagles, the Giants, the Steelers, the Packers, teams you guys care about, they're the biggest fan base I try to keep an eye on, and then just the teams that I like too. So you try to watch every game in the league before I press record. One team that I've found a lot of joy in watching so far this season has been the Colts. And I guess, you know, a lot of you, if you like sports, read the book Moneyball by Michael Lewis on Billy Beane. And it's one of the best books I've ever read. And then I kind of got to live it. When I was hosted a radio show for 3 years, we had the Ace. They were our broadcast partner. So during spring training, me and Guy, who I still do a podcast with, we'd go down to spring training, we'd be around the A's, and this was a couple years when they had really good teams. They made the playoffs a couple years. Josh Donaldson, Yoenis Cespedes, Sonny Gray was still good then. Like, they had some studs. Brandon Moss was hitting bombs. And it was Billy's, like, seventh team. And no one in baseball has done it like Billy, because he doesn't have the money to work with, and he has to change over the squad every 3 or 4 years because he can't pay the guys. So they become close to free agency, and he has to trade them. And Moneyball, I think it's become, like, kind of the gold standard, obviously, in sports. It inspired a ton of really smart guys at these Harvard, you know, these high-level institutions that wanted to get in sports but weren't athletes, and now a lot of them are running baseball, running basketball. Some of them are making hay in football. And it was an inspiring book. I mean, you read it, Billy, the difference, though, don't ever get it twisted about Billy Beane. Despite Billy Beane, I think he went out of high school, he went pro. This guy could have gone to Stanford. Like, Billy's really, really sharp. And he was also a first-round draft pick. So Billy's a kind of a unique character. But the one thing I always noticed, two things actually with Billy, is his locker rooms had high-character guys. I remember going in there just thinking it was going to be a ton of individuals because the spreadsheet was going to pop out just all these random individuals that were good at doing a specific thing. And then I remember going to the clubhouse in like 14 and 15 when they had, again, these teams were winning 95-plus games, thinking, damn, these guys are really tight. This is like a tight group of guys. He places an emphasis on character. And I remember interviewing guys that work for Billy. They're like, yeah, that matters a lot. We emphasize that. And I think sometimes the analytical guys don't care about that as much. Billy does. He understands the value of having good people in his clubhouse. And the team this year, they're going to host the wild card game. They're probably the fourth best team in baseball behind the Yankees, the Astros, the Dodgers, and whatever order you want to place them in. Then the A's. And his payroll is nothing. And his team is loaded. I actually think this team this year is better than those teams 4 or 5 years ago that I thought were damn good. And the other thing is that the big area of difference and separator for Billy relative to the majority of teams in baseball isn't that he has the best players. I mean, this year he has a couple guys that are elite. But for the most part, his 1 through 9, and really in baseball you have a 25-man roster. So in football, it would be equivalent to your 46-man roster, because on any game you can play those guys. Even though you have a 53-man roster, on game day you only have access to the 46 guys. On game day in baseball, you have access to all 25 guys. And his 25 guys on an everyday basis for 6 months during the baseball season, his worst player is usually way better than your worst player. Now, you might have better players, you know, 1 through 10, but where he kills you is like 11 through 24. His like 17th best player sometimes in his individual role that he asks him to do is so much better than your 17th best player, it's not even funny. And in baseball, over time, that separates. I'm telling you, that's the most underrated part of the Moneyball era, is his depth of talent. It's not necessarily his high end, and over this 20-plus year run of Billy Beane being the GM, he's had high-end guys. It's that his backups are so much freaking better than your backups. And even like his 7th or 8th guy in a starting lineup is probably better than your 7th or 8th guy, especially on the majority of the league. And I'm watching the Indianapolis Colts, and I've talked at length about Chris Ballard and how impressive he is. But the number one thing that when I see and I watch his team play, I flipped on the Colts against the Falcons. Julio Jones is the best player on the field. I mean, he might be one of the best players we've ever seen in the league. Sanu's a monster. I mean, the Atlanta Falcons have some premium players. The Colts, who's like their best player? T.Y. Hilton? Quentin Nelson, a left guard? For the most part, they're not a star-driven team. But the majority of their starters and the majority of their guys that they play are better than yours. They just out-depth you to death. They just, from a total 1 through about 40, however many guys you're playing on game day, they're pretty solid. They don't really have, yeah, that's a shitty player. I don't really say that when I watch them play. All their guys are good. Now, they don't have Khalil Mack and Patrick Mahomes, you know, and guys like that walking through the door. But every guy they're rolling out is at minimum just a functional starter. Then they have above average starters and a couple really good starters. That's why, and then you watch them, you go, well, they're a really good coach. They clearly, if you follow Chris Ballard, place a high level of emphasis on character. And you go, no wonder when Andrew Luck retires right before the season, even though, as I've said before, he was not going to play. They were probably going to put him on IR. Most teams, even if they knew the guy was injured, it would have crippled their season just because it would have been so deflating. It hasn't really affected the Colts. If anything, I think they look like a 10 or 11 win team with Jacoby Brissett leading them because of the depth, because of how many NFL players they have. They're just so deep, and not of just Pro Bowlers. This isn't the 94-49ers where they're rolling out 11 All-Pros and 15 Pro Bowlers and multiple Hall of Famers. What they're rolling out is just really solid NFL starters. And there's a reason when you go, besides like the Pats, most teams quote-unquote have holes. Well, if your holes in your position of weakness are still really solid players, they might not be difference makers, you can get by. And you can win most weeks if you have a really good coaching staff, which they do. Frank Reich, some of his play calls just jump off the screen. And if you know Chris Ballard, he takes his swings in the draft he's not taking swings for the fences. And that's typically the way I was raised in football, around Pat Hill and then Coach Reed and the Eagles. Like, I like a little more high-end talent. I take some swings. I even take some character swings. That my philosophy, the way I think about football, the way I was raised around the guys that taught me the game and the sport, that's just the way I kind of think. But I'm watching Chris Ballard do it, and I start questioning, should I start going a little his way? Because we saw when Bill Polian's team lost Peyton Manning, they couldn't win. They couldn't sniff 5 wins. This team lost Luck, and a couple years into Chris Ballard's building process, they're going to compete for 8 to 10 wins, no problem. Think how impressive that is. And you can only do that if your roster is really well built. The majority of teams in the league, I'm talking the majority of playoff teams in the league, would crumble. And it wouldn't even be that weird. They would have no chance to win 5 games if they lost their starting quarterback. Colts loser, like, whatever. let's roll. And their toughness, their just will to win. And to me, when you get will to win and the intangible stuff, that is based off the type of guys you're bringing into your locker room, and it just jumps off the screen. I mean, I'm watching a little humble brag on the treadmill this morning, just like, God, they are kicking the Falcons' ass. And whether the Falcons are that good or not, they are really talented. And before Neal went down, which, think how stupid it is, he tears his Achilles. I didn't see today, actually. They thought he tore his Achilles. By the time you listen to this, I'm sure it's out. I guess he slams his helmet. I'm listening to music, watching the game, so I'm not listening to it. Slams his helmet, he gets a 15-yard penalty. Think how stupid that is. Like, some of these referees, you guys are idiots. I mean, what are you guys doing? But they were just out-toughed. They were outclassed with just a will to win. Now, Julio Jones and Mohamed Sanu and Hooper and some of the offensive weapons that the Falcons have are really talented. I mean, their offensive skill guys, beside Matt Ryan, are freaking awesome. And Julio did everything in his power to keep them in that game, but the Colts as a whole. And it's the ultimate team game. One thing that fires me up more and more is when I see running backs hand the ball to their offensive lineman when they score a touchdown. That's something I notice good teams do. It's the ultimate team game. And they say it's cliche or whatever, but they say it for a reason, because it is. And the Colts, they're not going to win the Super Bowl. Hell, they might not even win a playoff game. They might get blown out in the first round of the playoffs if they play a Ravens or a Chiefs or a Patriots, or I guess they wouldn't play the Chiefs or the Patriots probably in the first round, but whoever they play, they might lose in the first round of the playoff game by double digits. But I am so damn impressed with their operation and the team they've built from top to bottom, because they're a great example of, if you build the thing right and you just get a functional quarterback, and Jacoby has moments where he's better than that and has moments where he's not as good as that, it's impressive, and you can win in this league. If you do it right and you know how to draft and you know the type guys you want in that locker room, my hat's off. I couldn't respect Chris Ballard anymore after watching his team through 3 weeks.
Hey, let's get to the Middlecoff mailbag at John Middlecoff, my Instagram handle. Slide up in those and ask me questions, and we'll bang out a couple. I'll try to keep this short just because we're already an hour and 10 minutes into this thing. Question for the pod. Still think Philly is elite? Lost two backbreakers that they should have won. Can't keep Carson from getting hit, and Carson isn't playing like a god every Eagle fan thinks he is. I disagree. I think Carson's been awesome. He was awesome in the opening weekend. I'm trying to think who they play. Oh, they played the Falcons 2 weeks ago. Like I said, I thought he was took over in the second half. And watching that game against the Lions, I thought for the most part, like, he can't hold on to the football. Alshon's gone. Deshaun's gone. I think he's playing pretty well. You can just, like I talked about earlier, you just got to overcome it. You know, sometimes you get handed a shit sandwich, and you just have to kind of come out with chicken salad, right? That's just part of the NFL. That's what makes it really tough. It's why Carson gets paid a lot of money. That's why Doug gets paid a lot of money. That's why Fletcher Cox gets paid a lot of money. They just have to figure it out, you know? And I think at the end of the day, they're too well-run an organization. Big game Thursday. But even if they lost, while I do think it's must-win just to kind of keep your head above water, they could get so many guys back, and, you know, they have the talent on their team, if they're healthy, to rattle off like 4 or 5 straight wins. So even if you're 1-3 or 2-4, if you can win 4 straight, boom, you're above 500. So is Philly elite right now? Of course not. They're not playing at an elite level. But there is, not an excuse, but there is a reason why they are not. And you can only take so many major injury hits and kind of keep on rolling. And again, I will fight for Carson Wentz and support his play because I think he's been really good. What are the elements of a good play-by-play color commentating crew? What separates the midday Sunday crews from the primetime guys like Michaels and Collinsworth? Also, I'd be interested to know how these crews are chosen for their respective assignments. That's a fascinating question. Maybe I should do an interview with someone at Fox that sets that up, how they do that. I mean, maybe that'd be kind of cool. I could look into that. And I actually kind of like that idea. I think that would be kind of cool. For me personally, Al's probably just the coolest, smoothest of them all. I think Mike Tirico is just really good. Same with Joe Buck. They just know how to call a game. They know when to talk. They know when not to talk. Nance a little cheesy for my style, but I love him in golf. Because I think I kind of watch him through the golf lens. But I think Tony Romo's kind of loosened him up. To me, the key with being a good play-by-play guy is you got to be a little loose. There are two elements for me personally, what I look for. Now, there are other things that play-by-play guys look in other play-by-play guys. I just know for me, as someone that has watched games now for a living for a long time and watched games, like one of the only true things I've ever loved doing, watch games, I would say have a good cadence for the plays, and when a big play happens, be a big play announcer. That's Al Michaels, right? You believe in miracles, he's a big play announcer. And he can just be loose and have a good time. There's something to that. And I think what makes a great color commentator, like watching Booger tonight, he's talking like cover two. I don't even know if he's right. Do you understand the average fan has no clue what that means? You have to dumb it down. And that's why John Madden is the greatest commentator of all time. That's why Gruden was so excellent. They can give you kind of this in-depth analysis in a dummy way that my mom can understand. I think Romo is kind of the modern version of that. I don't like Collinsworth, but I don't hate him either. He's just kind of meh. I actually think Chris Spielman. Is it Chris Spielman? Yeah, because Rick's brother's the GM. Is really good. I think there's an element of just a crew that it kind of feels like they're friends. I know my favorite crew in the history of sports is Dwayne Kuiper and Mike Kruko, who are the San Francisco Giants guys, and they're fun. They can, and now baseball's a little different because you got to tell stories. But you got to be able to make fun of each other. You got to be able to make fun of guys. And you know, I got to meet Dennis Eckersley like a month ago in the gym, and I was introduced to him by actually my doctor who does the A's and knows Eck. And I've just watched Eck through like a major league pass, and he's really critical. And I personally like that. Now, granted, I kind of have some of that in me, and I think most fans do. Because if you're sitting at home watching the game, it's different in football. Because, and this is what makes Troy Aikman really good, is he'll blast players. Because guess what? The fan of the team that's watching the game, when the guy screws up, he's blasting the guy on the couch. That's what the fan relates to. That's what you and me relate to when we're sitting on the couch watching the game. We go, what the hell is going on? So we want our announcer to say that. And I don't like cookie cutter commentators that are afraid to say anything. Like, who are you afraid to piss off? Now, I get if you work for a team and that makes it complicated, but if you're a national announcer, as they all are in professional football, right? Every game you watch, because there's no local broadcast once the season starts. So I like a guy that'll kind of rip a guy and not, you know, go out of their way to do it. But if you screw up, kind of blast him. You know, Dennis Eckersley does it to his guys in Boston, and Troy Aikman will do it whoever game he's calling. I think that's kind of separated him over the years because we're all thinking of it. Do you have the stones to say it? And if you have any what of a, you know, of a playing career, like a lot of these guys do that call games, like if you were a really good player, you have the stature to say something that, again, we're all thinking. So I'd say the key would be, from a play-by-play guy, be loose and be able to kind of make fun of yourself and make fun of situations and be a big play guy. So when a big play happens, you better be able to get to a 10. And then the commentator, be able to act like I would want to hang out with you. Be funny and dumb things down, because the common fan does not know what, you know, spider 2 wide banana is. They just don't. What cover 7, I don't even know if cover 7 exists. You know, cover 2 with, they just don't know what that stuff means. Because I've been in football now for 10 plus years, and it's complicated, especially defense. It's really complicated for people. So you got to be, and that's what made Madden so great. Can you dumb it down? I've been around a lot of coaches. When we have these conversations, it doesn't get that in-depth. Now, their game plan meeting and stuff does, but only super football nerds are in that game plan meeting as coaches and some quarterbacks. Huge fan of the pod. Appreciate it. After seeing the Saints beat Seattle the way they did, do you think they can survive without Drew and make a playoff run? Full disclosure, I haven't watched this game yet. I just saw bits and pieces on the Red Zone channel. But that's no way around it. It's a huge win. You know, they got what? They got was it a fumble six? And they got a punt return. So if you are going to win games without Drew Brees, you're going to need to score that way, right? You're going to need to get defensive scores. You're going to need to get special team scores. You're just going to need to create turnovers so you're in position for your offense. You know, Teddy Bridgewater went 19 of 27, 177 yards and 2 touchdowns. Like, hell, if he can do that and the defense can play well. I saw Pete Carroll, because a lot of people on Twitter is like, why is Pete Carroll going for it? I guess he went for it in some fourth and short and it cost him. You know, I don't know if it was Pete Carroll's best game. I did see that the clip of the ball hit him in the eye and he had stitches on his head. That's an impressive win. And there's a reason Sean Payton makes $8, $9, $10 million, whatever he makes. He's a big-time coach. So I'm not the biggest Teddy Bridgewater guy, but Sean Payton's good enough, and I think their team's good enough. Give this guy some credit. It's Dennis Allen. Has been a really good defensive coordinator these last couple of years for him. You know, he's a stiff guy. You know, he's one of those guys that looks like he only eats like kale smoothies and chicken salads. But he's a solid defensive coordinator. And ever since that Sean Payton's got him, you notice the Saints have been a lot better these last 3 years with Dennis Allen. Just wondering what you think about Frank Gore still performing at this stage of his career. He's set to pass Barry Sanders as the third all-time leading rusher in NFL history and is tied for 21st in touchdowns for running backs. I just think he's the ultimate pro. You know, when I think of a professional running back, I think of Frank Gore. He can run it inside. He can run it outside. He can catch. He can block. And he's an elite teammate. There's a reason you play that many years in the league. And his toughness is through the roof. I have nothing but the utmost respect for him. I think it's just, it's incredible that he's still doing it. I mean, I don't think anyone beside Frank Gore thought he would still be going at this level still to this day. But, yeah, it's just an incredible accomplishment. I think, you know, he's going to be, he's kind of like the Jason Taylor of running backs. So he's now becoming close to what looks to be first ballot Hall of Famer, but it's going to be hard to keep him out of the Hall of Fame. If he just keeps, you just keep accumulating these stats, even though at the end of the day, Frank Gore's, even in his peak, has probably never been a top three running back in the league. But I don't think that's going to matter just because at the end of the day, his numbers are going to be stupid. Raiders fan here. Is there any hope for this season we'll get better? Should I just look forward to the draft just 3 games in? Yeah, I mean, their schedule's brutal. Like I talked, I mean, they play the Colts this week. Then they got the Bears. Then they got the Texans and the Packers. They're just, they look destined to be a top 5 drafting team. And is Derek Carr going to be on this team? Like, if he plays like he did the last 2 weeks, he's not going to be on this team next year. He's not going to make it to Las Vegas. He just is not. And is it all his fault? No. But he has to play better if he wants to continue to be the quarterback of the Raiders. Gruden did not draft him. Gruden did not sign him to this contract. And again, I hate putting all the blame on him because their offensive line's terrible. Their skill guys are shitty. They put... And I don't blame Gruden once he acquired this guy. Once you acquire Antonio Brown, you build your whole offense around him. So all offseason, they're prepared to have 84, and then it blows up in their face, and they're left kind of just with nothing in their hands. They got Terrell Williams, which is a good, like, you know, complimentary receiver. Think about Terrell Williams. He had a lot of success in San Diego. I mean, L.A. Maybe, did he start in San Diego? But Keenan Allen was a one, and they had Gates and then Hunter Henry and Melvin Gordon. Like, he had a lot of help around him. Now he's the best player on their offense, and it's a problem. My question for you is, the 49ers' edge pass rush has been killer to start in winning them games. Do you think the edge pressure or pressure up the middle causes more problems for quarterbacks? Well, I mean, I know, like, Drew Brees and a lot of guys say always their pressure right up their face, because most good quarterbacks like to slide up. Most good quarterbacks don't like to slide left or right. Tom Brady wants to step up. Drew Brees wants to step up. Peyton Manning wants to step up. You know, some of these new school guys like Mahomes, I don't even think it matters. You know, that's, I think, I bet Coach Reed probably tell you that far of, like, step up, step right. You know, he'll step wherever. But I think the traditional pocket quarterback likes to step up. You could argue that some of these younger guys, they kind of float. I'm just kind of thinking this on the fly. It actually makes sense. Edge pressure might mess them up because they're naturally inclined to go left or right. Where I think a lot of the old school kind of prototypical studs have always been step up guys. But I watch a lot of the Deshaun Watsons, the Mahomes, even the Wentzes. It's kind of all over the map. Now, maybe that's just part of being young and just your natural instincts are not, like, in 10 years in the league, you just know. You know, it's ingrained in you. I think probably earlier on in your career, like Jimmy Garoppolo, he'll just roll out, you know, and a lot, those guys can get away with it. But as you get older, you don't move as fast. You got to be careful. I think Rodgers is a good example of this. He's always been king of, like, rolling out. Russell still does it too. Now, Russell has to do it a little bit because he has to see. But I would say edge pressure for some of these younger guys, and like Brady or Rodgers, or excuse me, Brees, 100% up the middle. That's a good question. It's a good little talking point there. Since the Packers started 3-0, are you buying them as a legit contender for a championship? Watch their game today, and, I mean, Flacco stinks, even though he actually didn't play that bad. The Broncos' defense gets no pressure, and they don't really have any wide receivers. But I will give the Packers a lot of credit on this. Their defense right now looks top-notch. Is it Preston Smith or Zaire Smith? I get the Smith brothers mixed up, but they cause havoc. Kenny Clark is a baller. Blake Martinez is just a tackling machine. Jair Alexander is one of the best corners in the league. The Savage kid they drafted just makes play after play. And they still have Davante Adams. Anytime you got Aaron Rodgers. Listen, I was not a believer in Matt LaFleur. And it's not like their offense is really knocking the ball out of the park here. But the one thing that can't be denied with them, that if you have a defense like that and Aaron Rodgers is your quarterback, you're going to be in pretty good shape to compete for, I don't know, a championship. But they're going to be in the mix come playoff time. And if you just keep winning, you get a 1 or 2 seed. It's not easy to go into Lambeau and win, and it's definitely not easy to go into Lambeau and win if they have a defense. Teams like the Niners used to be able to go into Lambeau and win, or the Giants, when their defense wasn't as good. Well, if your defense, you had a top five defense in the league, it's like the Bears. Good luck going in there and winning a game in the playoffs. Now, the Eagles did it, but they had a top-notch defense too. You have to have a top-notch defense to play with some of these teams in the freezing cold. Like, ultimately, that's one thing the Chiefs really need to shore up, is how do they figure it out where they can play on the Patriots level? Because at the end of the day, that game is going to come down to a play here or a play there. And it's going to come down to an open field tackle, a pressure. And we know the Patriots defense is special. I think the Chiefs defense is flashed, but for the most part, it's just not as good as the Patriots. Now, the Chiefs offense is probably better. But the playoffs really comes down to me more. That's the one thing that I won't change on, at least when you're playing outside in these cold temperatures. You're going to play in Kansas City in January. You're going to play in Chicago in January. You're going to play in Philly in January, in New England in January. Defense matters. Now, if you're coming to L.A. or you're playing at the Saints in the Dome or the Colts in the Dome, you can probably get by with not as good of a defense. But you're playing outside in 7 degrees and it's raining or snowing, you better have some bad MFers on the defensive side. You better tackle well, you better pressure the quarterback, and you better be well coached. And for the most part, it's pretty tried and true formula. That, I mean, look at the Chiefs last year. They had one of the best offenses we've ever seen. Now, partly as D Ford was offside for the game end. But, you know, that it was just their defense was ultimately the thing that let them down, not the offense. Okay, we'll call it a day. It was a long podcast. Adios. Godspeed. Hope you enjoy. See you a little later this week. Tell all your friends. See you.